Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show, where business owners, professionals, and entrepreneurs gather to discover playmaking ideas for success. Your host is internationally recognized speaker, facilitator, and author, Steve Klein, who sits down with fascinating playmakers who have made themselves and their company successful. Steve will introduce you to CEOs and executives who discuss their playmaking path toward success. And now, it's time to meet this show's playmaker. Here's your host, Steve Klein.
John Mackey said, "Resources are limited. Creativity is unlimited." Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show. I'm Steve Klein. In the studio today is a guest who has unlimited creativity. Today's Playmakers company has grown to $60 million in revenue with 500-plus employees beginning in 2007. With us today is a CEO whose company operates in 8 cities in North America. This great playmaker is Curtis Height. Curtis is CEO and chairman of Improving. Now, Improving is a software training consulting company which Curtis founded in 2007 with a focus on conscious capitalism. Curtis began his career as a software engineer, building systems in the defense industry, first with Rockwell International and then at E-System. In 1998, Curtis and several partners founded Xpeed, a software development, consulting, and training company. Its quick growth drew the attention of French company Valtech, which acquired them in 1999. Curtis soon became CEO of Valtech's North American operations. In early 2007, Curtis and many of the same partners established the Blue Ocean Group, which quickly acquired a small training company called Improving Enterprises and adopted the Improving name. Improving Holdings provides management and technology professional services, including consulting, project outsourcing, training, and network recruiting. The company operates in Atlanta, Cleveland, Calgary, College Station, Columbus, Dallas, Houston, and Minneapolis. Consistent growth has allowed Improving to be one of 116 companies that have been named to the Inc. 500 5000 as one of the fastest-growing privately held companies in the U.S. for 9 consecutive years. Well, I think we'll have a lot to talk about. Curtis, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you.
Well, you graduated from Texas A&M. You received both your BS and your MS in computer science. Was computer science your passion early on?
It actually wasn't. From a very early age, I was very enthralled with archaeology. And I liked computers, and I got into computers in high school. And when I went to Texas A&M, that is what I pursued my bachelor's in. But by the time I graduated, I got into their nautical archaeology program. And I went on several dives on shipwrecks in, up in the Northeast. It was a huge passion of mine, still is today, to be quite honest. But eventually, I kind of return tripped back into computer science and finished my master's work there. And then here I am today.
Did you have a feeling that computer science was going to be the future?
Absolutely. I mean, technology, at that time, it was a different day, right? I guess it always is a different day, but computer languages really were just emerging by relative measures, and so you could see this is where it was going. I got into the early stages of something called object-oriented design programming. And my graduate work was all in this area, and it kind of gave me an advantage for when I moved into the defense industry, and I became one of the local experts at that at the company at the time.
You said you did a little bit with archaeology between your BS and your MS.
Yes.
Are you still doing anything with that? Do you go on dives? Do you read about it? Do you look for it?
I read about it all the time. Subscribe to magazines, very interested in history, but don't get to do as much as that as I'd like.
So it's
but I will one day.
So it's more of a hobby for you right now.
Hobby, but it'll become a profession, is my best guess.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Improving. I mentioned in the intro, and I was talking about your bio, is you picked up a company called Improving Enterprises. Improving doesn't tell anybody anything, just from the outside looking in. What do you do here?
Okay, we build software systems, and we provide professional services, consulting, training, management consulting around building software services for our clients. So we might build an app on a phone, or we might build a B2B system, banking systems talking to other banking systems, websites. If you can imagine it, our teams can develop it.
So anything that has to do with computer science, you can do.
Software side of computer
software
science.
Software side of it, okay.
Yes, there's a lot.
You can put that together. You mentioned apps. That's a little bit different than other types of things you do. Has that become a major source of income for you?
It's becoming more and more a part of income. Apps are usually cheaper to build than some of the hardcore back-end systems. So
you were in the defense industry. Was that something you were looking for when you graduated, or what did they find you?
They actually found me. I was in the Corps at Texas A&M, and I think they actively recruited people that had been in the Corps. So they found me. I went to work at E-Systems. It was a great company. I enjoyed it. And that type of work, some of the most interesting projects that I ever worked on, actually.
What led you to starting your own business?
Okay, there's a long story there, but I'll tell you, it was hard to find people that knew what we did. We started an internal consultancy inside of E-Systems at the time. It had just been acquired by Raytheon. And we were trying to develop this consultancy, asked to break it off as a subsidiary. And a note came down from somewhere above, pretty high, I'll leave it at that, that said, tell the software we needs to get back to work. So we developed this business plan on our own, and we decided to instead try that business plan. And that's when we found some partners in the industry and helped found Expeed, and later became Valtech. Rest is history.
Training is a big part of what improving does. Is that unusual from your competitors?
Yes, training is a major part of our business. We're one of North America's largest providers of process training in Agile, Scrum.org training, actually. And we train several thousand people per year. That might sound a little bit more impressive than it is. It's a very fragmented market, but a lot of individuals providing training, but we are one of the largest providers, and it's a good service for us.
The website is improving.com. As I'm looking at it right now, under our services, training and coaching is your number one, the first one I see there. Then consulting, it's a big part of what you're doing to help your clients. Is that correct?
That is. It also gives us a way to be introduced into new clients. They get to experience us. Software development services can be quite expensive. They can be multiple millions of dollars. So how does a new partner get to know you a little bit better? So a lot of our partners will take training first, see the quality of the training, which I take a lot of pride in the reviews we get, a 99.8% return customer. So, and then we branch that into our other services, but the opposite happens as well. Almost all of our major consulting clients actually end up taking training from us as well.
So using that as almost an entree into everything else you do, as a way to get your feet wet, to find out more about what improving does, is that correct?
It is. It is an entree. It's something that's easier for them to buy. It's more, again, cost sensitive.
Well, in your office, it says trust changes everything. I'm looking at your website, again, improving.com. It says trust changes everything. What do you mean by that?
So we've discussed what we do. We build software. We consult around the building of software. However, I don't consider that our first job every day. I consider our first job every day to build environments of trust with our stakeholders. We're members of this conscious capitalism community, and it's very important to us to have meaning and impact in the industry that we're in. And our industry suffers from a lot of things. One is it's very fragmented a market. A lot of companies will build themselves up to around 20, 25 million and sell, and they just disappear. And then the other thing that I think is very important around the trust message is in ours is that there's a perception amongst CEOs that IT professionals are very difficult to work with. They have a lot of challenges, And some of that we have to own. We feel that that's rooted in trust and building trust with these senior level executives. So we lead with trust. That's the first thing we try to do every day.
In working with companies, I understand from what they have said is you can't get much higher as far as a relationship if trust is there, which I've heard is equivalent to love in a family. Once you have that trust, they will listen to you, and there's a lot of responsibility in dealing with somebody when they trust you. But at least with trust, you can help them move, and they'll listen to you. They're open-minded. Would you agree with that?
I do. And leading with trust can be scary, because as soon as you lead with trust, you know you're going to break it at some point. Not purposefully, but there will be decisions that are made or something along those lines that breaks trust. And then there's a lot of accountability that has to be taken. And that's, we subscribe to Stephen Covey's The Speed of Trust. There are 13 behaviors that we focus on a daily basis with numerous practices throughout the company. One of those is practicing that accountability. And then it's to right the wrongs, another behavior.
That's what I was going to bring up, is that with trust, stuff happens.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily how you take care of me when things go right all the time, but as a client of yours, it's how you take care of me when something goes wrong.
Absolutely. And delivering results, that's always our intent, another trust behavior, but sometimes we miss the mark. So what do you do to rectify that? And it often takes a lot of effort. There's another important part to that, too, though. It's the confronting of reality. And we try to work with our clients as well to understand that trust is not a one-way. It is bidirectional. And when there is a challenge, it's not always the customer that's right. I mean, although a lot of people want to believe that way. But where do you meet in the middle and try to have these productive conversations where both sides accept their accountability if a challenge arises, where both sides try to get better and both sides try to work through this? That's where real partnership comes in. And it's our aspiration to be true partners with our clients as well. It's important to note, we treat our suppliers just as good as we treat our customers. There is no difference in improving.
Let's talk about your customers and your suppliers. You lead with trust. You want them to trust you. Have you been in a situation with a customer or supplier where the trust broke down on their end and it was a parting of the ways?
Yes, that has happened. And because it's, I would not, I, out of respect for them, another trust behavior, demonstrating respect, I won't share the name, but it was at the time, the one that comes to mind that was such an example of this, one of our best paying customers, highest rates, they paid on time. And I remember having the conversation with the CEO, not the CIO who we're working for, and he brought all those things up. We're paying you good. And I was, yes. And I just, you pay us better than our other clients, pay us more even. However, I'm going to lose some of our best consultants, and we'll both lose them if I do. So I'm left with very little choice. And I just think that you should take that into consideration. We are leaving our best client.
I would think you have to swallow real hard when you make that decision. But again, because you follow conscious capitalism, you're looking out for your stakeholders. And some of the most important stakeholders you have are the people in your office, not necessarily the clients. And I would think that's the way you're looking at it. Is that correct?
It is. Our employees are a stakeholder, customers, the industry. We do a lot in the industry. The families of our employees are stakeholders. Our shareholders are stakeholders. All of these are very, very important to us.
Let's talk a little bit about what you do. You are the CEO of this company. You started out with some colleagues putting together, as I had mentioned, Blue Ocean Group, which
yes.
became Improving. How did you develop your leadership abilities and skills?
Well, I would say they're developed over a long period of time. And there's probably four or five events that represent major transformations. One was going into the Corps at A&M. In high school, I worked hard. I had a good work ethic, but I was, let's call it, the hero in high school. And I call this my hero to zero moment. You go to college, and I was in the Corps, and I was zero. And you learned an awful lot. And while I learned a lot in computer science, moving into the Corps was a huge experience for me, learning about leadership, learning how to follow first. I believe every great leader must know how to follow first. So that was a big lesson there. Dot-com was another huge lesson. I was in business with several partners. When things really went rough, three of the partners bailed and three of the partners stayed with the company and worked with the company to pay the debts and everything like that that we owed. So you learn about leading in the difficult times there, and that adversity really doesn't build character. In my opinion, it reveals it. Okay, and again, people make mistakes, no judgment there. I was laid off by Valtech. That was a big moment. You sell your company, and then 6-7 years later, they decide, amongst record performance, to let you go. And you're like, wow. So you get some humility around that, and say maybe the greatest thing from a leadership, maybe one of the biggest things that we did was partners and I, Rick, who is here with us still today, decided to share our company from the very beginning. Rick and I gave out equal, not amounts of equity, but we only had one class of shares. We didn't have a controlling interest. We could have been voted out of the company at any time, but we weren't. We had to lead. So many events go into forming who you are today.
Along with that, you've been in this industry for 20 plus years.
Yes.
Have you had any specific playmaking moments where it was an aha, or it was such a problem you had to overcome that to continue? Have you had that specific moment where if you didn't do it correctly, it would have fallen apart and you stayed with it and you made it happen?
I'm going to talk more about the sharing of the equity here. It is something that is so unique to us. I had the largest stake. It was 13% in the company. So more or less, you have a founding CEO that from the beginning was planning to give away 87% of the company. And many people wouldn't take that step. I'd say most would not take that step. But it is probably the single biggest reason for our success today. And we should approach $100 million this year in revenues. And we got there because we shared in the success. It wasn't just a couple people taking the success. It was many people sharing in that success. And as we brought on a private equity partner in Trinity Hunt, they actually supported this model and moved forward with the model. Many private equity groups wouldn't have considered it.
That was a big move to make. Was there anything that caused you to make that happen? Was it something that you were aware of? Did you read about it? How did you make a decision to make everyone that works for improving a partner in this company?
Some lessons we learn from the good things that have happened in the past, and some lessons we learn from maybe some of the less than stellar events of the past. And one of the things that learned is that in the first business, the equity model was not aligned with the contributors. And when it's not aligned with the contributors, there's a lot of hard feelings. And I think there was a lot of people had trusted me, had trusted the other leaders from Raytheon. Several had come over and started the company with us. I don't know the word, betrayed might even be, felt there were some feelings that we as a group had been betrayed. And I kind of was, that's not going to happen again. That's not going to happen here at Improving.
So you want to make sure that anyone working for Improving never felt what you felt
Yes.
working for some of these public companies.
Right. and even starting an own company where that happened. And you don't have hard feelings. I'm very loyal. A lot of people here are very loyal, and you want good things for the people that show support.
Have you had any specific obstacles you've had to come over the years that was such a defining moment that it was a difference between success or failure?
Sure. I mentioned .com. Enron was our largest client at the time. And when they filed for bankruptcy, about a third of our business was with the Enron group of companies. We thought we were diversified, being in five of their different companies, but the whole thing went down. And you had to lay off a lot of people. A few of our partners left the company during that time period or right before. And those that stayed with, I remember working with our bank, who's still a bank with us today. And we, despite not being paid by Enron, being owed millions and millions of dollars, we worked for 2 years to pay every single debt down. But our bank worked for us. And there's a big kudos to Silicon Valley, who worked with us during that time, didn't force the hand, but gave us a chance to pay down everything. And that was a big defining moment, I think, for most of the leaders that stayed behind.
Which I would guess made improving stronger.
Yeah, that was
in the long run.
In the long run. That was back at Valtech. And now, but the same leaders that did that, all of them are here today.
What's next for improving?
I mentioned we have a very fragmented market. So many consultancies, it's very low barrier to entry. A few consultants can start. They can maybe build it to 2 or 5 million. If they're fairly good, to 10, a very few get to 20 to 25 million, very few. And then they have a tendency to sell. I want to be the next company that can make a difference that doesn't sell. And we're on our path. We share this vision with Trinity Hunt. And hopefully we'll be a true mid-market player. And there are very, very few in the United States and North America. So that is our vision, leading with trust and kind of stepping out there boldly where a lot of technology companies won't.
So you want to be the go-to company?
Yeah, I think everybody wants to be the go-to company. I want to be the trusted company. I want to be the company that partners can work with in both good and bad times.
Seeing how this company was built in conscious capitalism, and that's a big part of your culture, is there any specific advice that you would give for someone that wanted to start a company?
Sure. I'll say first that the people you start with are important. Sharing the business, maybe not as much as what I did, but sharing your success. It's not all about you. There are a lot of people that have a lot of dreams. A lot of these dreams are tied to certain financial things. Share in that success with them. There's plenty to go around. The second, take this approach to the stakeholder model. It's not just your shareholders. It's not just your employees, your clients, but there are these important stakeholders in the communities, the industries that pull them in. And you'll find that when you care, when you care about them, they start to care about you as well. And just take a little bit of that leap of faith.
I would think, if nothing else, just the knowledge power you get from those stakeholders can help you dramatically.
Hugely, right. And you get all these stakeholders start, when they start buying into the company, they contribute to the company. They refer people to company. They give you ideas. They introduce you to people who have ideas. And it just really plays upon itself.
Should someone want to find out more about improving, where would they go?
Well, the best place is to go to our website, www.improving.com. However, we have a very open culture, and we would welcome you to visit our space. We have groups that use our space every night, professional groups, about 20,000 people we supported last year. But email me. That's fine, right? I'll do my best to respond, and just reach out to anybody. I think we have a good culture. I think lots of people would be willing to respond and talk with you.
Well, Curtis, thank you very much for being a part of Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you very much.
You are definitely a playmaker, and a playmaker is somebody that's making something happen. But not only are you making something happen, but everybody around you is contributing to that too. So congratulations for that.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to us. This has been a terrific show. Join us again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com, where you can get all of our past episodes. That's PlaymakersTalkShow.com, and we'll be back with more Playmakers. See you then.
You've been listening to Playmakers Talk Show with Steve Klein. Join Steve again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com for more interviews with interesting and successful playmaking CEOs and executives.